This article appeared in the winter 2009 issue of UU World magazine and is available online at uuworld.org. The Religious Left, An Old Tradition for a New Day, by Daniel McKinnon. For the past three decades, many political commentators have assumed that the United States was divided between the religious right and the secular left. Churchgoers, in the prevailing media image, were anti-gay and anti-feminist. They preferred private charity to public welfare. They waved the flag whenever the United States sent troops overseas. Liberals, by contrast, were depicted as big city elites with disdain for heartland prayer, unwilling to utter even a friendly Merry Christmas or a patriotic God Bless America. Unitarian Universalists often felt left out of this picture, and so did Roman Catholics who cared about poverty and evangelicals who worried about global warming. In many ways, the picture reflected the worldview of a newly assertive political movement, the religious right, which assumed that anyone who questioned biblical literalism was a hopeless secularist. But even those of us who were left out of that picture rarely questioned its accuracy. When it comes to God's politics, progressive evangelical Jim Wallace complained, the right gets it wrong and the left doesn't get it. The 2008 U.S. presidential election shook up this tidy picture. Barack Obama, a former faith-based community organizer with an inspirational story of conversion to Christianity, was elected with the enthusiastic support of agnostic college students, goddess-worshipping environmentalists, African-American Protestants, and Latino Catholics, not to mention a slight majority of white Catholics and just under half of all white mainline Protestants. The campaign introduced Americans to the fiery Black Power preaching of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, the evangelical environmentalism of Richard Cizik, and the Reverend Rick Warren's puzzling blend of support for AIDS research and opposition to gay marriage. We also witnessed an outpouring of quasi-religious devotion directed at Obama himself. Clearly, the relationship between religion and politics is not what it once seemed. From a longer historical perspective, things are getting back to normal. Despite its recent prominence, the religious right is only about 30 years old, while the religious left has a genealogy that stretches back more than two centuries. In every generation, people of faith have brought their bodies and spirits to the causes of human freedom, racial and gender equality, economic solidarity, and global peace. Catholics and Calvinists, theological liberals and evangelicals, adherents of indigenous spiritualities and immigrants of every faith have worked to extend the radical vision of the American Revolution to all peoples. Indeed, it is nearly impossible to separate the religious from the secular left in U.S. history. Americans are among the most religiously observant people in the world, and we bring our diverse pieties to social change movements. Deeply religious reformers have sometimes broken their ties to the churches not because they had lost faith in God, but because they believed the churches had broken faith with the divine cause of justice. Other reformers remained in the churches but drew inspiration from non-religious radicals. Ostensibly secular organizations, such as the Industrial Workers of the World at the turn of the 20th century and the hippie communes of the 1960s, claimed kinship with Comrade Jesus and developed their own rituals to foster a radical faith. Unitarian and Universalist participation in the religious left stretches from Judith Sargent Murray's feminist writings in the 1790s to our current campaign to stand on the side of love with immigrant families and gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. But we often misunderstand our place in the movement. Many of us experience liberal religion and radical politics as mutually reinforcing, but they are logically distinct. Unitarian Universalists embrace liberal theology, but some take moderate or conservative positions on socio-political issues, just as many religious leftists from John Brown to Dorothy Day have been orthodox in their theology. A broader awareness of the theological diversity of the religious left can help Unitarian Universalist activists build more effective alliances. The cause of liberation. America's religious left was born not in the theologically liberal churches that would embrace Unitarianism or Universalism, but on the shores of colonial Virginia and South Carolina, where enslaved Africans found the strength to keep living in the songs, dances, and rituals of their traditional faiths. It took on a new flavor when the children and grandchildren of those Africans discovered a message of liberation in the sacred books of their captors. "Let my people go," thundered the God of Exodus. These words, coupled with the protective amulets of African folk religion and the international network of Freemasonry, inspired a series of insurrections that rattled the slave system. And in the free but deeply segregated North, black preachers Richard Allen and Jerina Lee refused to accept secondhand status in the white churches, creating African congregations to honor the principle that there is neither slave nor free in Christ. The religious left expanded as European Americans listened to the testimony of African Americans. The Quakers were among the first. By the late 18th century, the Philadelphia Friends excluded slaveholders from membership. A generation later, Quaker editor Benjamin Lundy launched his Genius of Universal Emancipation. After moving his paper to the heart of Baltimore's free black community, in 1829 Lundy welcomed a young New Englander, William Lloyd Garrison, as associate editor. Radicalized by his encounters with African-American teachers and activists, Garrison was soon jailed on charges of libel because of his vigorous attacks on a slave-trading sea captain from his hometown. In 1831, Garrison returned to Boston to launch The Liberator, a newspaper that challenged Northern racism as well as Southern slavery, focusing particularly on the American Colonization Society's scheme to send freed slaves back to Africa. For the next 30 years, Garrison was the central figure not only in the abolitionist movement, but also in a radical coalition that championed women's rights, nonviolence, economic cooperation, and religious freedom. Alternately venerated and despised in his own day, Garrison's fervent style and paradoxical personality made him an emblematic religious leftist. It is worth dwelling on some of these paradoxes because, for better or worse, they have shaped social change movements ever since. A few white victims must be sacrificed to open the eyes of this nation, Garrison declared after his release from jail. By publicizing his own imprisonment, Garrison turned the ancient religious tradition of martyrdom, the veneration of those who suffer for the faith, to political ends, setting a standard that would be emulated in later years by leftist prisoners Eugene Debs, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and Mumia Abdul-Jamal. Millions of activists have been inspired by these martyrs, yet their legacy raises troubling questions. Should people who suffer under oppressive systems seek out more suffering as they work for change? Does the practice of martyrdom drive a wedge between a self-suffering elite and the rest of the movement? Similarly, Garrison's choice to attack the American Colonization Society as well as slavery itself was an effective tactic of agitation. Many colonizationists were eventually convinced that people of African descent were fully a part of the American community, but it also established a precedent for less fruitful schisms. Within a decade, the American Anti-Slavery Society had split over women's rights, pacifism, and participation in politics. post-Civil War feminists divided over the relative priority of voting rights for women and for African American men. Socialists, communists, and anarchists went their separate ways early in the 20th century, and integrationists clashed with black power advocates during the civil rights era. Though many activists longed to draw people together rather than splitting them apart, they achieved fleeting unity on only a few occasions, most notably the Civil War, the years just before World War I, and the beginning of the civil rights movement. Garrison also had a paradoxical relationship with religion. Raised by a devoutly Baptist mother, he initially assumed that churches would be his allies in the cause of freedom. When both evangelical and Unitarian churches refused to host his meetings or exclude slaveholders from membership, he turned bitterly against them, attacking first the Sabbath, then the clergy, and finally the Bible itself. But just at the time when he was universally regarded as an infidel, he added a giant picture of Jesus to the masthead of the Liberator, along with a stirring biblical quote, "I come to break the bonds of the oppressor." The infidel was unwilling to cede Jesus to the more conventionally religious. Garrison was by no means the only giant of the religious left in the abolitionist era. His pacifist comrade, the Reverend Aidan Ballou, a minister who served both Universalist and Unitarian congregations, as well as launching the communal village of Hopedale, was the era's great theorist of nonviolence, carefully explaining that the non-resistance of Jesus really entailed fervent resistance to evil by means of non-coercive love. This vision traveled around the world, influencing Leo Tolstoy in Russia and Mohandas Gandhi in India before returning to the United States during the Civil Rights Movement. The pioneering feminist Elizabeth Cady Stanton credited Garrison with helping her saw off the chains of my spiritual bondage. She would anticipate 20th century feminist theology in her Woman's Bible. Frederick Douglass, the most famous fugitive from slavery, was also an early religious humanist, declaring in one speech that he could see glimpses of God only in his comrades in the anti-slavery movement. Among those comrades was John Brown, a fervent Calvinist whose Harper's Ferry raid was largely funded by radical Unitarians. American socialism was also born during the abolitionist era, partly at Hopedale and other utopian communities, and partly through the pioneering journalism of Universalist Sarah Bagley, who launched the Lowell Offering as a voice for female mill workers in Massachusetts' first factory town. The rise of the social gospel. After the Civil War, the single most influential leader on the religious left was Francis Willard, a revivalist Methodist who served 2 decades as president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. It may seem strange to list an anti-alcohol activist as a leader of the religious left, but from the 1830s to the 1930s, the temperance cause was as integral to the religious left as environmentalism is today. Willard's motto was to do everything to liberate families from the scourge of alcoholism, and on this basis she endorsed both women's suffrage and socialism. A much less divisive leader than Garrison, she built a national movement that included evangelicals and theological liberals, African Americans and Southern whites. Her coalition politics had its own shadow side, however. When anti-lynching activist Ida B. Wells Barnett claimed that in some cases white women seduced black men and then accused them of rape, Willard attacked her for impugning the purity of Southern womanhood. The result was a tragic division between 2 activists, despite the fact that both recognized that most cases of lynching did not even involve an accusation of rape. Over the course of Willard's career, the religious left was transformed by urbanization. As immigrants, most of them Catholic, Jewish, or Asian, streamed into the sweatshops and factories of Chicago, New York, and San Francisco, Urban Protestant pastors were first alarmed by the threat of anarchy and then inspired by the struggles and faith of the workers. Gradually, they glimpsed a social gospel that required Christians to ask, "What would Jesus do?" when confronted with the poverty of their neighbors. By the early 20th century, the mainline Protestant social creed demanded collective bargaining rights, old age insurance, an end to child labor, and a living wage as a minimum in every industry. Meanwhile, the immigrants brought their own religious traditions into the American left. Reformed Jews allied with Protestant social gospelers, while other ethnic Jews translated their faith's prophetic idealism into the new idiom of Marxist socialism. Roman Catholics became mainstays of the more moderate trade unions. When Pope Leo XIII initiated a tradition of Catholic social teaching that sought a middle path between socialism and capitalism, he built on work that was already being done by American bishops and unionists. Together with the social gospelers, these Jewish and Catholic activists turned religious idealism into concrete legislation early in the new century. World War I brought the era of progressive legislation to a traumatic end, as Americans rallied uncritically to a war-to-end war. But the war also brought together a cluster of pacifist ministers who lost their pulpits or denominational status as a result of their preaching against the war. During the Roaring Twenties, these ministers, all members of the Pacifist Fellowship of Reconciliation, would plant the seeds of future activism. The Reverend Norman Thomas, a Presbyterian who had ministered to a working-class church in East Harlem, became the Socialist Party's perennial presidential candidate. The Reverend John Haynes Holmes, a Unitarian, built the Community Church of New York into a hub of civil liberties and anti-racist activism and introduced the American public to Gandhian nonviolence. The Reverend A.J. Must became a labor educator, gravitating theologically from the Dutch Reformed Church to Quakerism and Trotskyism before experiencing a dramatic reconversion to Christian pacifism. By the 1940s, Must was America's number one pacifist, according to Time, and the most important link between the social gospel and civil rights generations of American activists. With African-American civil rights leaders Bayard Rustin and James Farmer, he began using Gandhian techniques to fight American racism. With Catholic worker Dorothy Day, he resisted the logic of the Cold War by refusing to participate in New York City's civil defense drills. New York's decision to discontinue the drills was one of the first victories in an ongoing fight against nuclear weapons. A different tradition of religious activism was born in Chicago in the 1930s under the leadership of a man who was never particularly religious. Saul Alinsky was raised on the tough streets of Chicago, the child of Orthodox Jewish parents. As a student of urban sociology at the University of Chicago, he was attracted to the union organizing methods of Congress of Industrial Organizations leader John L. Lewis, and began to wonder if these could be used to organize neighborhoods as well as workplaces. They could, he concluded, if local congregations, the most powerful institutions in urban neighborhoods, were enlisted in the cause. In Chicago's back-of-the-yards and Woodlawn neighborhoods, Alinsky fine-tuned his approach, going on to train a national network of organizers and win the enthusiastic support of Catholic leaders who would eventually channel hundreds of millions of dollars to Alinskyite projects. By the 1990s, virtually every metropolitan area in the United States was home to a congregation-based community organizing project supported by one of several foundations committed to Alinsky's methods. All the traditions of the religious left came together in the work of Martin Luther King, Jr. A child of the Black Freedom tradition, King was the son and grandson of two of Atlanta's most influential Baptist pastors. Educationally, He was an heir of the northern missionaries who partnered with freed slaves to found Morehouse College, as well as of the social gospel tradition he encountered at Crozer Theological Seminary and Boston University. King readily embraced Gandhian nonviolence and made economic justice the centerpiece of the Poor People's Campaign, which he envisioned as the culminating work of his career. As the United States' foremost social prophet, King echoed the witness of the Hebrew prophets, celebrated the democratic ideals of the United States, and insisted on a radical confrontation with the evil triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism. With King's assassination, the religious left succumbed to the schismatic fragmentation that had bedeviled it since Garrison's day. The rise of black power gave the African-American community a new religious and political depth, but few white allies responded with sufficient creativity to maintain earlier practices of interracial cooperation. Indeed, one of the few groups to maintain its interracial radicalism into the 1970s, People's Temple of San Francisco, was itself victimized by the sociopathic personality of its leader, Jim Jones. The rising queer, feminist, and environmentalist movements so rattled some anti-war stalwarts, like the Reverend Richard John Newhouse and the theologian Michael Novak, that they began a strange pilgrimage to the far-right wing. Many more activists traded in their religious commitments for a free-form spirituality that others stigmatized as too individualistic to change society. The religious left today. These divisions could not destroy the religious and spiritual left. Arguably, it is as strong at the grassroots as ever, though it has had few public policy successes in the past generation. Today, it can be understood as four overlapping clusters. First are the grassroots activists who continue the work of the radical wings of the civil rights and anti-war movements. Many of these activists live in Catholic worker houses, 185 of them in both rural and urban areas, or the new monastic communities proliferating today. During the 1980s, many offered sanctuary to refugees escaping United States-sponsored wars in Central America or traveled personally to Central America to learn from liberationist-based communities there. Typically, they espouse a deeply biblical theology, declaring, with Dorothy Day, that the Sermon on the Mount is our manifesto. Yet many break with biblical literalism in supporting full equality for women and full inclusion of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer persons, even though they may devote more of their activist energies to economic, racial, and peace issues. A second cluster is centered around the denominational bureaucracies of the mainline Protestant and Roman Catholic churches, such as the Unitarian Universalist Association's Washington Office for Advocacy, which continue the social gospel tradition of working for progressive legislation, relying more on lobbying and letter writing than on the direct action favored by the first cluster. Social justice lobbying networks provide avenues for lay people to shape their own political involvements according to their denomination's commitments, and Alinskyite organizations for congregation-based organizing provide rich opportunities for people of many faiths to find common ground in living wage, anti-racism, or neighborhood renewal campaigns. A third cluster includes all those who identify primarily with the theologies of liberation that reached a peak of influence in the seminaries in the 1980s. These activists are more radical in their policy prescriptions than the denominational bureaucrats of the second cluster, and they sometimes prefer revolutionary violence to the active nonviolence favored by the first cluster. Theologically, they often position themselves against what they take to be the excessively optimistic liberalism of the social gospel. In principle, they insist that each oppressed community must form its own distinctive theology, though in practice, advocates of black and womanist, Latino and mujerista, queer and feminist, Native American and Asian American theologies have fought side by side against interlocking oppressions. The biggest but least organized cluster includes spiritual but not religious people and many others for whom social activism is inherently spiritual. Some may have embraced religious traditions like Buddhism or Wicca, or they may draw eclectically from diverse spiritual traditions. Some, notably feminist witch Starhawk and Zen teacher Roshi Bernie Glassman, are rooted in early religious left traditions, while others are still groping to find their own activist voices. Unitarian Universalist congregations provide a welcoming home for many of these seekers. As the era of the religious right comes to a close, these four clusters have a remarkable opportunity to forge real solutions to climate change, economic inequality, and the persistent injustices of racism, sexism, and homophobia. Just as people of diverse faiths joined together in the anti-slavery, social gospel, and civil rights movements, so today we have the power to change the world. But we will do it only if we blend an awareness of our history with a creative openness to the possibilities of the present. Daniel McKinnon is the first Ralph Waldo Emerson Lecturer in Divinity at Harvard Divinity School. His next book, Prophetic Encounters, A History of Religion and the Left in the United States, will be published by Beacon Press in 2010. He and his family worship at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Medford, Massachusetts. Breath is Life, A Christian Rationale for Abortion, by Scotty McLennan. Editor's Note: The Reverend William Scotty McLennan, a Unitarian Universalist minister, is the Dean for Religious Life at Stanford University. He is also the inspiration for cartoonist Gary Trudeau's Doonesbury character, the Reverend Scott Sloan. His latest book, Jesus Was a Liberal, Palgrave, 2009, offers a thoughtful case for liberal Christianity, including this theological justification for abortion. Whatever your own theological views may be, we hope this essay will give you a fresh perspective and help you in conversations with Christians about this controversial subject. The Unitarian Universalist Association has consistently supported a woman's right to choose abortion since 1968. See tinyurl.com/UUAabortion. I preached a sermon in Stanford University's Memorial Church after the national elections in 2004, mentioning that exit polls showed 22% of Americans nationwide put moral values as their top issue. Commentators had explained that, no doubt about it, abortion and gay marriage were the wedge issues that separated the Republicans from the Democrats in the voting booth. Those moral values voters went for President George W. Bush by 79%, as compared to 18% for Senator John Kerry. I am personally deeply concerned about moral values, and I didn't cast my ballot for Bush in 2004. I affirmed in a post-election sermon that I'm a professing Christian among many who, on religious grounds, is pro-choice on abortion and in favor of gay marriage. At the talkback after the sermon, a Stanford student asked me to explain my statement that I'm pro-choice on abortion on religious grounds. He could understand how I might be pro-choice on pragmatic grounds, or on the basis of a political philosophy that we shouldn't legislate what other people can do in their private sexual lives. But he had certainly never heard anyone defend a pro-choice position on explicitly religious grounds. He thought the only genuine Christian position was, and ever could be, anti-abortion, and therefore anti-choice. I gave him a brief answer in the talkback, reminding him that most mainline Protestant Christian denominations, along with Reform and Conservative Jews, have issued pro-choice proclamations consistently over the last 30 years. I also admitted that I hadn't preached on this subject in my years at Stanford, and that I should probably say something about it from the pulpit. So in December, in the midst of Advent, when the gospel reading and the lectionary was the Magnificat of Mary, her hymn of praise to God for the promised birth of Jesus from her very womb, I preached my Christian rationale for abortion. Why, in the midst of a period of expectation of the birth of the Christ child in the liturgical calendar, would I speak about the religious justification for abortion? Precisely because Mary's position in the Advent story is similar to that of many women who choose to have an abortion, and yet so very different. She's young and poor. She faces unexpected pregnancy, not something she has planned for or wants at this time in her life. She isn't married yet. She knows what this might mean to the man she wants to marry. He'll realize that this can't be his baby she's carrying because they haven't had sexual relations yet. Even though she's formally engaged to him, this could mean the end of their marriage before it begins. And sure enough, as it's reported in Matthew's gospel, once Joseph found out Mary was pregnant, being a righteous man and unwilling to expose her to public disgrace, he planned to dismiss her quietly. The account in Matthew continues in this way. But just when he had resolved to do this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. So, Mary's situation is utterly unique. She is the most blessed among all women. She is to be favored by becoming the mother of the Son of God. After she questions the angel Gabriel when he first visits to tell her of her favor with God, and after some soul-searching, Mary makes a voluntary decision, as the Gospel of Luke puts it, to allow the Holy Spirit to come upon her, to have the power of the Most High overshadow her. Mary says, Here am I, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word. Precisely because Mary's situation is utterly unique, it places in bold relief other girls and women who have not voluntarily chosen to become pregnant. How about an 11 or 12-year-old, or a teenager, who has been continually forced to undergo incest by her father or stepfather? What about a woman who is forcibly raped on her way home from work by someone she never met? Or a Stanford student who was date-raped by a fellow student whom she thought she knew rather well but obviously didn't? What about a mature woman, even one who's happily had other children, whose physical or mental health might be severely compromised by this pregnancy? What about a fetus that has been found through amniocentesis or ultrasound to be severely and irreversibly impaired? Of course, the cases go on and on, including those so often cited by anti-abortion activists, those women who are allegedly having abortions of convenience, which undeniably does happen. I want to make it clear that I respect the views of religious people who are opposed to abortion because they truly consider it to be murder, or simply to be wrong on other conscientiously considered grounds. There are many of them on the Stanford campus in the Catholic community, evangelical Protestant groups, and other religious organizations. My job as Dean for Religious Life is to be sure that their voices are not squelched or censored and that they can flourish and thrive in religious communities. I personally would join them on this issue if I thought that an embryo or a fetus is fully a human being or a person. I don't think a woman's right to choose is a sufficient answer to the claim that abortion is murder. If by abortion we're killing human beings or persons, then a woman does not have a right to choose to kill, except in the very limited circumstances of self-defense, where it's a matter of either she dies or the fetus dies. say in an ectopic pregnancy or with certain kinds of cancer. Yet, fetus as person or human being has never been a settled question within Christianity or Judaism. There are large segments of the Judeo-Christian world that historically and currently see the embryo or fetus as potential human life, but not as fully human until birth, or until some stage in fetal development well past conception. My personal religious understanding is that human life or personhood begins at birth. But I also think there are important protections that should be applied to potential human life at certain stages of fetal development. Let me trace some of that religious history now, especially since the Bible is appealed to by so many anti-abortion Christians. This discussion may seem a bit technical, but I believe the background is important to understand. There's nothing explicitly said in the Bible about induced abortion. Zero. The Jewish position begins with Exodus 21, verse 22. When people who are fighting injure a pregnant woman so that there is a miscarriage, and yet no further harm follows, the one responsible shall be fined what the woman's husband demands, paying as much as the judges determine. So, only a fine, no punishment for homicide. On the basis of this passage, the rabbis argued in the Talmud that a fetus is not considered Adam, human, and has no legal standing as a person. Killing a fetus is not murder, and it is not treated that way. The mainstream Jewish position, historically and today, is that human life or personhood begins at birth, when we take our first breath. There are a number of biblical passages that have been cited by rabbis over the years as connecting the breath and human life, starting with the creation story in Genesis 2, verse 7. The Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. This is not to say that Judaism doesn't take the value of potential life in the womb very seriously, before and after the heart starts beating and brain activity begins. Historically, as required in Exodus, there have been fines for killing a fetus, and, in the words of the conservative rabbinate, the decision to abort should not be taken lightly. Most Orthodox rabbis approve abortion only to protect the life or health of the mother. Conservative rabbis sanction abortion under a wider range of circumstances, but always thoughtfully and prayerfully. The Reform rabbinate leaves the decision whether or not to terminate a pregnancy in the hands of a woman or her family, but recognizes how difficult that decision often is. For most of the history of the Catholic Church, one did not become a human being or a person until well after conception. St. Augustine, in the 4th century, adopted the Aristotelian belief that the human soul didn't enter the fetus until 40 to 90 days after conception. In roughly the same era, St. Jerome emphasized human shape. The seed gradually takes shape in the uterus, and it, abortion, does not count as killing until the individual elements have acquired their external appearance and their limbs. The apostolic constitutions of the late 4th century allowed abortion if it was done both before the human soul entered and before the fetus was of human shape. St. Thomas Aquinas of the 13th century followed Augustine in not considering the abortion of a non-ensouled fetus to be murder. Pope Innocent III, earlier in the same century as Aquinas, emphasized that the soul enters the body at the time of quickening, when a prospective mother first feels movement of the fetus. When Pope Gregory XIV affirmed the quickening test for ensoulment in 1591, he set the time for it as 116 days into pregnancy, or the 16th week. The great reversal came with Pope Pius IX in 1869. He assumed ensoulment at conception, and by 1917, church canon law had been revised, dropping the prior distinction it had upheld between animated and inanimated fetuses. Pius's position has been maintained by the Roman Catholic Church ever since. Likewise, criminal abortion statutes generally didn't come into effect in the United States until the latter part of the 19th century. The common law had long held that an abortion performed prior to quickening was not an indictable offense. Even abortion of a quickened fetus was generally not considered a criminal act under the common law, or at most, a mere misdemeanor. The U.S. Supreme Court, in its 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, used religious references to explain in part why the word person, as used in the U.S. Constitution, does not include the unborn. There has always been strong support for the view that human life does not begin until live birth. This was the belief of the Stoics. It appears to be the predominant attitude of the Jewish faith. It may be taken to represent a large segment of the Protestant community. I'm personally part of that large Protestant community that believes that human life and personhood begins at birth. Some of my feelings admittedly may stem from the connotations of the words birth and conception with which I have grown up within the church. We speak of Esau and others in the Bible having a birthright, not a conception right. After a strong religious experience, we might say we've been born again, but not conceived again. Various biblical characters speak of the land of their birth. We honor the birth of the nation of Israel. We celebrate birthdays, including Christmas, as the birth of Christ. I have done a concordance check of the Bible and found 216 references to birth or born, and only 43 to conception or conceive, a 5-to-1 ratio. The majority of the uses of conceived were linked to being born in this way. She conceived and bore a child. I'm also personally compelled by the notion that it's the breath of life that makes us full human beings. I'll never forget the sight of each of my children emerging into the world blue and lifeless, being struck on the back by the doctor, taking their first breath, and becoming ruddy-colored as they began crying their way into life. Now they were tiny people. Now they had joined the human race. Not before. On the other hand, it seems religiously important to me to be very concerned about potential life, not just actual life. Christians celebrate Advent as a time of waiting in the darkness for the light that will come at Christmas. The 9 months of pregnancy for an expectant mother is a very important time of preparation for the baby to come and, ideally, of careful monitoring of maternal and prenatal health. Fetal life is a magnificent continuum of development from the zygote at the time of conception to the manifestation of the embryo at about 14 days, to the formation of what we call the fetus at about 3 months. Of course, for those first 2 weeks, it's not at all clear that the zygote will become a singular embryo, much less a human being. 2/3 of the time, the zygote doesn't develop into anything at all. Sometimes it develops into a tumor. Or it could become an embryo or more than one if it splits into twins. Once it's an embryo, it'll be a long time, another 22 weeks or so, before it reaches viability, or the stage of development when it might survive outside the womb. This is where I personally think the Supreme Court got it right in 1973 in terms of protection of potential life. During the first trimester, when abortion could occur with an IUD, a morning-after pill, RU486, or minor surgical procedures, the decision to abort is entirely the woman's. In the second trimester, with quickening, human shaping, and the necessity of more complicated surgical procedures, the state has a right to regulate medical procedures to protect the health of the mother. In fact, less than 10% of abortions now take place after the first trimester. By the third trimester, though, the potential life has become viable, since the fetus could now live outside the womb. The state has a right to protect that potential life by prohibiting abortion except to preserve the life or health of the mother. Despite all of this discussion, I want to emphasize that I and many other religious people of all persuasions would like greatly to reduce the incidence of abortion. As the Lutheran Women's Caucus resolved in 1990, abortion should not be the stopgap for lack of contraception, for inadequate sex education, or for irresponsible sexuality, not to mention being resorted to because of insufficient social support for new human life, such as lack of health care, child care, or parental leave. I join in the call of the Lutheran Women's Caucus to work actively for social and cultural changes that will reduce the incidence of abortion and also stop the scapegoating of women who have abortions. Nonetheless, there are strong religious grounds, historical and contemporary, to defend a woman's right to an abortion. The Reverend William Scotty McLennan, a UU minister, is the Dean for Religious Life at Stanford University. He is also the inspiration for cartoonist Gary Trudeau's Doonesbury character, the Reverend Scott Sloan. His latest book is Jesus Was a Liberal. Excerpted with permission from Jesus Was a Liberal, Reclaiming a Christianity for All. Palgrave Macmillan, copyright 2009 by William L. McLennan, Jr. The UUA offers a variety of resources on women's reproductive health at uua.org, including a study guide for the film Sacred Choices and Abortion, which prevents a variety of religiously based pro-choice views from Christian, Muslim, and Jewish perspectives. For links to this and other resources, visit uuworld.org, click Current Issue, then choose this article. A Poet's Grief. Kathleen Sheeter Bonanno's poetry chronicles her passage through grief after her daughter's murder, by Kimberly French. Kathy Bonanno hurtled along a Pennsylvania highway through a hard rain. She was rushing toward the almost certain news that her beautiful, open-hearted daughter had been murdered. The first person she called from the back seat of her brother-in-law's speeding car that night in July 2003 was the Reverend Kent Matthies, the new young minister at her church, the Unitarian Society of Germantown in Philadelphia. Later, Bonanno turned those moments of grasping hopefulness and crushing certitude into a poem, How to Find Out. Here, capturing when the police chief met the car at her daughter's apartment. Don't make the poor man say it. See how human he is? He has children of his own. It is your job to ask, is she dead? And he will nod and say yes. And now he can never not nod. And now he can never say no. And now he can never not say yes. The poem is part of a narrative collection of 41 poems Bonanno wrote about her journey through grief. Slamming Open the Door, winner of the 2008 Beatrice Hawley Award. Published in April 2009 by Alice James Books, the book is already in its third printing. The night before her 21-year-old daughter was murdered, Bonanno had spoken to her by phone. Just graduated from nursing school, Lady had recently broken off a brief relationship with a phlebotomist she had met at the hospital where they both worked in Reading, Pennsylvania. Then she had discovered he had been using her credit card and had stolen her Social Security number through the hospital's employee database, which Lady reported to his supervisor. To her mother, the warning signs were clear. The ex-boyfriend, Joseph Eady, was very angry, both about the breakup and about the call to his boss. Lady had also just learned that Eady was married. Later, the family learned Edie had several children and was AWOL from the Army. He had also told Lady, who was born in Chile and adopted by the Bananos, that he, too, was Hispanic and had been rejected by his mother. Both untrue. Kathy Bonanno had pleaded with her daughter not to stay at her apartment that night. Lady had promised she wouldn't. That night, Edie came to the apartment and strangled Lady by wrapping her telephone cord 3 times around her neck, a crime for which he was later convicted and sentenced to life in prison without parole. For 2 days, Kathy and her husband, David Bonanno, frantically tried to reach Lady by phone. After no word, the Bananos called the police and asked them to break into the apartment, and then sped toward Reading. Death of a child, especially a brutal, senseless death of a child, is surely one of the heaviest griefs to bear, presumptuous to imagine by anyone who hasn't experienced it. Some readers may not want to imagine it at all. As with the Daily News, what can we do but feel sorry, pained, outraged, and most of all, helpless? Yet, slamming open the door is no more grisly than the news, with its daily tales of murders that suck us in, curious, willingly or not. Bonanno invites us behind the numbing headlines and into her heart, into her rage at the murderer and at an insensitive trial junkie, and into her fantasy that it couldn't be true. She shows us what it means to lose what is most dear. She plumbs what is universal about loss, so that it is impossible not to feel that, yes, we do need to know, we do need to share our stories with one another, that this is about more than the horrific loss of one life. The poems are untinged by sentimentality, so spare that a reader suspects there must be much, much more. Still, what seems most remarkable about them is how much truth she tells, how she lays bare the hard facts and emotions. She shows us the moment after the verdict, for example, when the murderer's mother, whom she despised, came to her, Bible in hand, and said, "I am so sorry." And the only thing she could do was embrace her truest other sister. She doesn't shy away from the volatile anger of her son Luis when he learned of his sister's murder. The Bananos had adopted the biological siblings when they were 3 and 4. At the same time, the slightly nutty, self-deprecating, even sardonic side of Kathy Bonanno also shows up in her poems. In What Not to Say, she writes of standing in the receiving line at the funeral, "Fat and having taken enough clonopin to still an ox," and recounts how one mourner sees the opportunity to invite her to Weight Watchers. "I didn't write much that would offend people, except the murderer and perhaps the defense attorney," she says, "but that was just too delicious to leave out." Writing poems about her daughter's murder was absolutely necessary, both as a poet and as a grieving mother, she tells me, during a visit to Philadelphia earlier this year. "I wanted to continue writing poems, but I couldn't fathom that," says Bonanno, a contributing editor of the American Poetry Review, where she met her husband, who is the co-editor. "For a long time, I could barely read a book. But for me, to write any book, I had to write this book first. It was the mountain that stood in the way of the mountain." Within days of Lady's death, Bonanno wrote Poem About Light, which closes the book. She read the poem as her victim's statement at Edie's sentencing hearing, and her sister read it at Lady's memorial service. Matthies, her minister, calls it a profound theological poem. For several years, the few poems she wrote were all about the murder. In the summer of 2007, Bonanno, whose day job is teaching creative writing and English literature at Cheltenham High School outside Philadelphia, stayed in her pajamas till 11 each morning, writing, hoping to complete that chapter of her grief by creating a book. I wanted to follow the advice I give my students, to distill each poem to the fewest number of words, to not manipulate the reader, to let the story tell itself, and to let the reader feel what the reader would feel. Kathy Bonanno's Unitarian Universalism has been central in weathering the tragic journey of the past 6 years. She freely mentions her UU beliefs, church and minister, in the poems themselves, and as she promotes the book. In The Unitarian Society of Germantown, she depicts the old Georgian-style stone church as a big wooden boat where she, her husband, and the others waded out together. "I rewrote that so many times," she says. "I'd still be rewriting it if someone hadn't snatched it out of my hands." Hours after she made the backseat call to Matthies, the 300-member church swung into action, forming 7 committees. Everyone wanted to help, making the funeral big and beautiful, just as Kathy wanted, bringing food, walking the family's dogs, counseling the congregation's youth. This is a very tight church, a very good church in terms of caring for each other, Matthies says. "When somebody's down, it's all hands on deck. I felt like we were floating off the ground with all the love that was pouring in." On a hot day later that July, some 500 people overflowed the sanctuary. Church members had turned the chancel into a wall of sunflowers and daisies. At its center, a photo of Lady and a walnut box holding her ashes. There was a flower communion, candles for adults, yo-yos that looked like ladybugs, Lady's nickname, for children, and lots of music, including Lady's favorites by Coldplay, Shaggy, and Savage Garden. The openness and delicacy the church showed the family, taking cues from them about what they needed to do or hear, and never glossing over the hard truths, was a real blessing, Bonanno says. A lot of churches would be busy applying their dogma onto our experience, even if that application hurt us, saying things like, "It was her time," "It was God's will," or "She's in a better place now," she says. But we're used to ambiguity. We're used to struggling with hard questions. The church made us feel. You can come here no matter what you're believing this week about where Lady's gone. If we see you cry, we'll let you. Or maybe we'll hug you. Or if we see you run out of the sanctuary, like I did at one child dedication, people didn't blink an eye. We get it. And we'll see you next week. The murder of a young innocent person is a punch to the gut of Unitarian Universalist theology. Our very first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of each person. A short poem called Communion recalls the court hearing when her minister gently suggested forgiveness someday. "Because, after all, he must," she writes. Her reaction was a visceral no. For a long time, she admits, she wanted to kill Edie herself, and might have if she'd known how. Being a Unitarian Universalist and being a family member of a victim of violent crime are very hard things to reconcile, she says. There was something for me at the time that was true and right about my hatred toward this man and my desire for revenge. Thank God we live in society where there is redress, she continues. Being Unitarian Universalist, I don't want to live in hatred. I do believe men in prison have the possibility of redemption here on earth, and I do feel peace and comfort in the fact that he was arrested and found guilty. Matthies says he believes Bonanno has found a ministry to grieving families. They are putting together a pocket prayer book for UUs who are in despair. Family and friends sang Spirit of Life in a stairwell during the trial, but at other times Bonanno found herself reciting the Our Father and Hail Mary. In times of crisis, you defer to what's committed to memory. I was sad there wasn't something UU. Bonanno came to Unitarian Universalism 23 years ago, attracted by the powerful, articulate older women she met on anti-war picket lines. Today, she has turned her own activism to anti-violence and victims' rights, speaking and holding fundraisers for groups such as the National Parents of Murdered Children, the Berks County Women in Crisis in Reading, who showed up out of nowhere just when we needed them most, and a small Philadelphia organization called Every Murder is Real, which supports the often forgotten, often poor families of drug-related murder victims. My whole family, we live our days with intentionality, she says, trying to do good in ladies' name, loving in ladies' name. Kimberly French is a UU World contributing editor. Poem About Light by Kathleen Sheeter Bonanno. You can try to strangle light, use your hands, and think you've found the throat of it, but you haven't. You could use a rope, or a garrote, or a telephone cord, but the light, amorphous, implacable, will make a fool of you in the end. You could make it your mission to shut it out forever, to crouch in the dark, the blinds pulled tight. Still, in the morning, a gleaming little ray will betray you, poking its optimistic finger through a corner of the blind. And then more light. Clever. Nervy. Impossible. Spilling out from the crevices, warming the shade. This is the stubborn sun, choosing to rise. Like it did yesterday, like it will tomorrow. You have nothing to do with it. The sun makes its own history. Light has its way. Reprinted with permission from Slamming Open the Door, Alice James Books. Copyright 2009 by Kathleen Sheeter Bonanno. UU World is the magazine of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. This recording is made possible by the UUA Department of Communications and the UUA Accessibilities Office. I'm Dick Hill. I'm an audiobook narrator, and my website is www.dickhill.com.